higher in. So understanding the Eightfold Path and understanding the these different kinds of ideas. But now, those teachings get broken down into two different categories. They get broken down, one, for the monastic, for those that have done renunciation of everything, family, work, home, all of that kind of thing. And then there is the other group, which are the lay followers, the householders. And I'm going to mention something here in just a moment. I got to bring this text up myself. What is it, lay followers? Mm-hmm. It should just come up like that, right? Yes. You're just going to give me that one, not the PDF? All right. So, I want to mention something. There are... Let's talk about these vows very quickly, because there's lots of confusion within the Buddhist community of who is what and what it means. So, the first grouping of renunciation is everyone. Is anyone who is taking refuge. They're all considered a renunciant. So, all of you that have your refuge vows are also a renunciant at the very lowest level. Why? Because you have renounced your previous systems and paths to lead to enlightenment. Or, sorry, liberation. We're not concerned with enlightenment. We're talking about liberation. So all of our past methods of how we're going to attain this freedom from suffering, we abandon. And we say, from this moment on, I'm only going to turn to the Buddha Dharma, and the community that he put together. That's it. That is my new form, my new mode of trying to attain liberation from suffering. So you're a renunciant. Everybody has it. The next level of renunciation, everybody also has, which are five precepts. And we renounce five old patterns of behavior. That is, we decide we are no longer going to kill. We're done murdering people, and so we're not going to do that anymore. We're done with the lying and the cheating and the stealing and the drinking and all of these other things. And so these five principal things, everybody renounces. A few go on to take the next level of renunciation, which are called eight precepts. That is also those first five, and then you add three more. And the laity do have this also. There's lay people that take this vow, and that's so everybody also can have it. Very few, I find, have eight in the lay community. Most is five, that's it. So, and that's where it ends. Is at the eight precepts. Because if you add two more, you become a novice monk. Now you're homeless. That's it. So, obviously, a householder cannot be a householder with no house and no job. That's not a householder anymore. Maybe you're a hermit, but then you're the same as a novice monk. That's at 10. That's where the branches split. But for the lay community, they have a thing called acharya. So acharya takes on a certain number of vows in order to become disciplinary leaders within their community. That's the equivalent to priest in training or a novice monk who's trying to be a swami. You say, wait a minute, Swami. Yeah, that's what it is, all right? We have all kinds of fancy words, you know, the bhiksu and all. But well, let's not speak Chinese. Let's speak the terms that the Buddha would have said. So a Swami is the fully ordained monk in the Buddhism. And the main reason why we call it that, and it's all the same, is because it hinges on one primary vow above all other, which is celibacy. And there are, in the Buddhism, 270 vows for a monk. A full monk. That's the highest ordination that they can attain. So they go from 10 to 270. And that's it. Now you have a full Swami. The other thing is, those that take that vow, take it for all future lifetimes. They will never not be a monk. They're stuck in that system forever. That's it. I mean, not stuck. I mean, they're choosing that. That's fine. So it's the same as the sannyasa, and that's why they wear the same color and all of that, because they're monks. Although, you know, the Chinese and Japanese and all, and they've all changed the color system. But originally, Buddha said, this is the color of the swamis, and that's all for his order. And they're in total poverty all the time. Now, they have complete authority as fully ordained monastics. Swamis are the leadership of the Buddhist community. For, listen carefully, all of those renunciants of like kind, meaning everybody that has 10 or more. Sometimes, if they run a temple that's open to the public, we lay people go in there, and they're running it because it's their ashram. Okay? Using the Sanskrit, it's an ashram, a monastery. We're going to see monks. They don't build these for people like us. They're built for monastics to live in. So when we go there, we have to follow their rules and their stuff. But there's a whole nother line of completely ordained. And that's called the Nagpa. The other term is the priest. They are fully ordained, equal to the monastic. And they are ritual masters of everything outside a monastery. So if it's not in the four walls of an ashram, the priests are in charge. Buddha established this. He first created his monks, and we call those the eight great arhats. Sariputra, you know, Ananda, and Sabbuddhi, and Sariputra, all those guys. And then he had his eight great bodhisattvas, which were all householders. That's Manjushri, Avalokitesvara, Vajrapani, Samantabhadra, and so forth. They he ordained as the priest to oversee everything that has nothing to do with a monk. So those are our two huge ordained communities. Some groups like the Chinese don't recognize that anymore. Why? Because they decide that they only wanted to worship monastics and not have priests in their system, even though there had always been priests in their system. And in Japan, they went the opposite way, got rid of all the monks and only have priests. And in the Himalayas, they have both, but they don't care about the monks, they only care about the lay Nagpas, which, for whatever strange reason, break the vows by wearing monastic clothing, even though they all have wives and children. It's crazy. You're not supposed to do that. But they do. So who cares, really? I'm not Tibetan. I don't care what they're doing over there. That's on them. Our issue in CAB is to follow the teachings of Buddha. Now, we as householders, not ordained. This is Buddha talking to us in this text. I want to make that very, very clear. Of all the different groups, there are three groups: monastic line, the Nagpa line, the priest line, and then we have the lay community. And the idea of lamas or gurus, that's a whole different topic that we'll discuss at another time. So let's look at what the Buddha says to us, having now understood that we're supposed to be doing the six paramitas, the eightfold path, and so forth. Lay followers of the Buddha, a collection of teachings from the Mahanama Sutta, the Anguttara Nikaya, the Gilayanam Sutta, Avatamsaka Sutra, Mahaparinirvana Sutra, and the Mahamaya Sutra. And, in this sutra, and even though there was only a little bit left, we'll save that for our next talk. But let's go back to the very beginning of the sutra, and let's take a look at only the very first portion here. The Buddha has talked about already. The only way that we can become a disciple, a devotee of the Buddha, is we must believe in the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the Buddha goes on in that previous discussion to say how, which is the taking of refuge. And that, of course, is a ceremony that, though it can be quite small and just on the fly, which the Sanskrit term is bidwat. Bidwat is without all of the huge pomp and circumstance. A person can take refuge, or it can be something grand, like a very big ceremony. The Buddha established an ordained community, as we mentioned earlier, the Swami level, the bhikshu, or whatever they want to call themselves, and then the priest line. He established this in order to maintain the structure and the authenticity of the teachings for as long as possible. I want to throw that in there, because this is a Dharma declining age for Buddhism specifically. We have lost a tremendous amount of the Buddhist teachings, and a tremendous amount of the teachings that's left of that portion, we have lost the essence of those teachings. So we are working today with a very small sliver of authenticity, which is why it's very, very important that we protect even that, because it, unfortunately, is going to continue to deteriorate. It's like a house that's falling apart. We may put a post to try to hold it, but eventually it's going to go. And we're not going to save it. And that's the way it's supposed to be, because the Buddha said so. He said, once my teachings are completely destroyed and everybody has ruined them thoroughly, then the Maitreya Buddha is going to come, and he's going to give a whole new dharmic system. So who knows, maybe we're going to come back all as Hindus or something. But whatever it will be, Maitreya will have an entirely new system. And maybe there won't be refuge. I have no idea. We don't know. But it will be new. But in the meantime, Buddha says, in order to try to keep some level of authenticity here, we're going to set up those that are ordained. And the ordained are people that have heard these teachings, applied these teachings personally, and have practiced these teachings to the point where they have some level of a realization. Enough so that a other ordained person recognizes their level of accomplishment and offers ordination to them. That's not always true with the bhikshus. I want to point that out, because unfortunately, and I'm not sure why he did this, but the Buddha says, a lay person who takes the 10 vows becomes a lay monastic only needs to remain that for a time period. So after 6 months of being a novice, they can take their Swami vows, but that has nothing to do with how accomplished they are. They might not be accomplished at all and still be a bhikshu. That's a little bit tricky. It's much more difficult to become a priest. But when we go for refuge, we have to take refuge from them, from the ordained. Now, I know being in the West, we don't like to be told what to do. We'd rather just make it up ourselves and do it however we want. And we think that we can, because that's our opinion of Eastern philosophies and religion, is that, well, no one can tell you what to do.
Western.
Huh?
Western.
Yeah, the Western idea is that they think this of Eastern philosophy. So they turn to the Dharma, whether it's Buddhist or Hindu, and they think, oh, well, you can just do whatever you want. And that's not true. Even in the Hindu system, that is absolutely not true. It may look like that because of the hippies that hung out over there and then brought it back here. But most of them aren't really all that authentic. And the ones that are, we don't pay a whole lot of attention to. Why? Because they went what we call over the deep end. They went too far. Well, not really. They just realized you can't make it up. So they dedicated themselves to a teacher in the path, and then they accomplished their goal. So in order to take refuge, we go to an ordained member of the community, and we say, I wish to receive the refuge vows. I want to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then they either tell you to wait till the next big ceremony, or they give it to you right then and there, or maybe next week. You know, they say, come back next week, we'll talk. Who knows? But that's the first thing that the Buddha says you must do. Well, in order to do that, one must have unshakable faith in the Buddha. Is that true? No, it comes after taking refuge. In order to take refuge, your only qualifier is that you think there might be something there. And you're willing to go in and test it. It's a test. It's not, you don't have to believe in everything or be struck by lightning. That's different religion. That's not Buddhism. I know there's religions that do that. This is not one of them. The unshakable faith in the Buddha comes from engaging with his community, especially seeing those more advanced practitioners and hearing their stories of where they come from and how their struggles in the practice of Dharma brought them to the realization that they have. It's a fantastic thing to engage the Dharma and listen to those people that are enlightened. Not every Buddha is a priest or a monk or a nun. A lot of them are just a lay person sitting next to you in the seat, fully enlightened. Whether they claim it or not, that's a whole different story. But a lot of them are. And so when you engage them and you, well, how did you get there? And they tell you the struggle and so forth of you know, trying to meditate or trying to do a daily reading or whatever it is that they struggled with. Maybe they struggle with a mantra, who knows? Some of them struggle with just instructions coming from the ordained community. Because that's the other thing the ordained do, they give you instruction. And if you can't put those into practice, that will hinder your path. And so some people really struggle with that. And at some point, they break through. They submit. They do the practices, and they come to their realization. The unshakable faith in the Buddha is that we basically accept, okay? We don't take and absolutely believe it. We're not talking about Jesus Christ or some weird thing like that. We're talking about Buddha. And so we take it at face value. Okay, this guy claims his enlightenment. I'll buy it for now. That's all you have to do. You only have to be there. And we say, okay, so that guy over there, he attained it. That's fine. And he was able to pass it on to all these others. The more you engage in spiritual reading, the more you engage in the personal practice, and the spending of quality time with other practitioners, especially those more advanced than you, you begin to see that influence. That influence organically creates the faith in you. You don't have to blindly accept anything. In fact, if you do, you're going to be in a load of trouble. Because the Buddha is absolutely opposed to blind faith. That's ridiculous. So unshakable faith comes from remaining in the community and engaging it and perceiving the direct benefit or indirect benefit of it. Then he says you must believe in the teachings, the Dharma. Well, sure. Why would you do it if you don't have some kind of growing faith in it? Now, please keep in mind, the Buddha says, look, all you need is one of my teachings to believe in. So if you don't want to believe in an afterlife, that's fine. If you don't want to believe in God, that's fine too. If you want to believe in God, that's fine. If you want to believe in angels and demons, that's fine. If you don't want to, that's fine too. Nobody cares. Even the Buddha. He's not interested. It does not matter. Those are not points to argue. They have nothing to do with enlightenment, which is the only thing the Buddha teaches on. So what we need to do is find the one thing. Oh, this attachment to blank. Or the aversion to blank. Well, that kind of hits home. Great. Focus on those teachings and start trying to apply them and see what happens. That's all. You don't have to believe in the myriad of Buddha realms all over the place with these bodhisattvas and these dakinis flying around. No, you don't need that. If you do, that's fine. The teachings are there. Follow them. If you don't want them, then ignore those and do something else. The Buddha taught 84,000 teachings, of which we have four. I'm making that up. But we really have hardly any. Just find the one that hits down in the pit of your stomach and you kind of go, ooh, yeah. What about that one? I mean, I've been a mass murderer for 42 years of my life, just going around with my little knife, stabby, stabby, everybody that I see. And the Buddha says to stop killing. I have no problem with stealing, so maybe I'll practice no stealing. Look at how good I am at it. That's not useful. This is not useful. But if you have a problem going around and poking people with your knife, then let's practice it. Let's engage those teachings. By engaging the teachings, you'll begin to see for yourself. You will see, right? You will see results happen. And as you see the results, you will begin to actually believe organically. It's no different than, and this is a test that you can do at home. I hope you don't. I really hope you don't. Don't sue me if you do. But you can climb a tree in the park and jump out and see what happens. If you fall on the ground, will you believe in gravity? If not, do it again. How many times do you jump out of the tree and hit the ground until you believe? Do we even have to call it believing in gravity? I mean, is that what we do? Do we walk around having the conversation, like knock on your neighbor's door and go, today I want to talk to you about believing in gravity. Have you heard of it? Have you done that? Because believing in gravity will save you from the depths of hell. Well, that's true. Because if you don't believe in gravity, you're going to do the most ridiculous things and wonder why you always hurt. So, yeah, you know, I don't know what it is, but I'm constantly banging up my elbow into my knees, into my head. And the doctor says, well, what do? I keep jumping out my third-story window. Why? Why not? I'm just trying to get over to the garage. And he would say, that makes no sense. You jump out the window, you're going to... I mean, do you have stairs or a fire escape? No, I just jump out. Fire escape. Yeah, fire escape. That helps. They're safe. It's way better than jumping out the window. You know what the doctor would tell you, right? There's something wrong with you. Why do you think you can jump out the window? Okay, Dharma's the same way. So when it says, the text says, you have to believe in the teachings, must believe in them. It's not like that. It's not like a guy hands you a book and says, you have to believe in this book. Even if you haven't read it, you got to believe in it. That's crazy. The thing that's missing from this portion, and I'm afraid to put it in because we're not supposed to alter teachings. Although it does come from another part of the Buddhist teachings. Buddha says, test everything that I'm teaching you. Test it first. See if it works. If it works, then claim that you have faith in it. If it doesn't work, throw it away and try a different one. Until you've exhausted all of my teachings. If you do not find one that works, then you can call me false. That's what the Buddha says. Then I shall be a false teacher if none of my methods work for your liberation. But if you find even one that works, you have found your one teaching from the Buddha. And thus you can claim faith in the Buddha and that teaching. And you say, yeah, but that teaching exists elsewhere. But where are you getting it from? The elsewhere or from the Buddha? If you didn't get it from the elsewhere, then don't claim the elsewhere. Even if you heard it before. That's what the Buddha means. He says, study, put the precepts into practice. And cherish your community of fellow practitioners. Because that's what's also going to help you come to realize the deep meaning of the practices. It's not a cult setting where you're going to be brainwashed into just hanging out with these people. The point of hanging out with Sangha is that when you see the teaching and go, shh, I don't know if that's going to work. Well, look at the others around you. Did it work for them? Are you seeing any reflection? Do you see somebody and go, I wish I was more like that? Look at how calm and peaceful they are. That was one of the things that I had to kind of discover, is because when I first came to Buddhism, I had my whole world out there, and then I had my 2 days a week in the temple, which, you know, I'd go there and pretend to be just like everybody else in the temple. And I thought, in all reality, I thought most of the people that had become my friends only in those four walls, I'd never seen them outside, were doing the same thing I was doing. Which is, you have your Superman uniform, and you're running around all crazy, hitting the bars and the clubs and everything else with your Superman uniform, and then you put on your Clark Kent dress and go into service. And pretend that you're all nice with a suit and tie, and you're calm and naive and all of that. But you're not an idiot. Because as soon as you go outside, you tear open your vest, and boom, you're Superman, and you go out and you act completely crazy with your rum and cokes. Because that was my system. Rum and coke everywhere. All the time, constantly, till I discovered bourbon, that was it. Then it was bourbon in one hand and rum and coke in the other. But I had my big Superman S. Yeah, for super drinker. Super partier. Super life of party, so I thought, because when you're that drunk, you never know. You have no idea if you're actually the life of the party or not, because, hey, you're having a great time, and it seems like everyone else is. Even when the bouncers are throwing you out, you're like, we're just having fun, man. Right? Then you put on your disguise, and you go in and pretend to be calm like the Sangha. So one friend of mine invited me to his house for dinner. And I thought, well, okay, let's go over. And oh my goodness, this dude was completely calm, like he was in the temple. And I thought, well, maybe he's just got his Clark Kent dress on while we're having dinner. Maybe he's like a little whoosh when we get out and, you know, what do they call it? Letting your hair down. This. Woo! Now we're crazy. Let your hair down, right? Because these things are so blasted tight. Okay, so I would, and my goal then was, I'm going to get my friend to put his hair down. Let's see what happens when all the dakinis are let loose. So I took him to some of my favorite places, not bars, but some of my favorite outings. Which were tempting because there's bars everywhere. You go down to the beach, Ocean Beach in San Diego, and it's a block lined with crazy clubs and everything going on. And I thought, we're going to go there. I'll take him out on the pier. We'll hang out. You know, I mean, he's from San Diego. He knows all this stuff. And we'll see if he says, hey, let's stop in and get a beer or something. Or maybe I'll say it. Then we'll see what happens. And the whole time, he's super, like, calm. He's Buddhist. I'm thinking, this is terrible. So, my favorite place, it's like the last restaurant on the strip right before you get to the parking lot in Sand. I always go in and buy a bucket full of mussels and a beer. And I say, let's stop in here and get some beers and some food. He goes, yeah, sure. And I thought, okay, here we go. So I go in, I order my mussels and I order my beer. He orders like a Coke. I'm on my, like, second beer, thinking about having a third. He's on his third Coke. Nothing. And he was like that for years. Drove me crazy. I started thinking, what? And so I asked him, what happened? You have all these stories of being super crazy. You know, smoking out all this stuff. Like the Superman suits do. What happened? And he said, oh, yeah, I used to do all that stuff. Then I started hanging out with Tom. Tom, by the way, is our founder, Venerable Tom Graham. He started hanging out with that guy, who was the translator to Venerable Master Sun Yun, the patriarch of all Chinese Buddhism. That's who he's going to start hanging out with? And he says, over time, I didn't even have to do anything. I felt this deep connection coming through Tom to Master Sun Yun. And from Master Sun Yun, I felt this deep connection to Shakyamuni Buddha's teachings and all these people that have spent countless lifetimes and hours slaving for these teachings to be presented to me. And so I put them to use, and I didn't need the Superman uniform. And so I went home angry, thinking about that. And while I was laying in bed angry, I decided, that's it. I'm doing that. I'm tired of all this other stuff. That's what I was actually angry about. Is that wearing that dual suit still was not giving me what I searched. This is the purpose of the Sangha. The purpose of the Sangha is to be enriched. Joyful, happy celebration. To come together and go, look at this. Even if you accomplished sitting meditation once this week, you can go, man, I sat this week one time. And the Sangha will go, woohoo! You keep going, man. Keep on keeping on because you got it. You did it one time, you're going to nail this. And I remember, like, being a little kid like that. Coming into class, you know, and seeing Tom sitting there, and I'd give him my report. You know, like a little kid. Look what I finger painted today. And I'd do that. I'd come in and I'd say, look at this, man. I sat for 25 minutes undisturbed. And then he, just like a parent, would go, wow, that's so great. Now, I know, he was just being super nice because, what? Sitting once for 25 minutes? Just kidding. Those of you that are struggling with 25 minutes, that's great. That's a huge accomplishment. I'm serious. It really is. You can attain your enlightenment in that one sitting. Keep it on. Keep going. You're doing great. Because it doesn't matter about time. It did for me because that wasn't enough for me because I was too slow. I needed to put more effort, more work. The Sangha's there to encourage that, to bring that happiness. Buddha then tells you, make sure you never neglect it. As much as you possibly can, get together with your community. Have potlucks. Householders have houses. Invite people over. Celebrate holidays. This weekend was Krishna's birthday. Oh, yeah. And then I can hear everybody, why Krishna? Yes, Krishna's birthday. Master of the universe, supreme lord and ruler and all of that. It's his birthday, so we went out and we did a celebration last night. It was fantastic. So those of you who believe in God, there you go. This is a big holiday today, largest in the world. Population-wise, bigger than Christmas. It's true. Make up your own. Look at the date of when you took refuge. That's your birthday. Throw a big party. Hey, everybody, come over. Let's, we'll have a nice meal and we'll all sit. Do a meditation and then, you know, hang out. Why not? Fellowship is incredibly important. So, with that in mind, keep going. Wherever you're at, that's great. Keep going. Stick with it. Do it. That's your belief. That's the expression of you actually believing. Otherwise, you wouldn't keep coming back here. So you already have everything you need to be considered a disciple of Buddha. Keep going. So that being said, let's try a 15-minute meditation. And we'll close out our service with that.